And Lila, is it all right if we record your presentation?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So Lila Alphonse is our main speaker. And she actually invited us to edit her bio, but we're deciding to read it in its entirety because it's a really powerful and fascinating story of a woman's professional journey and of your impact in the world. So I would like to read it all. So here we go. Lila Alphonse is a former managing editor at U.S. News and World Report, where she revamped their special reports section, coordinating news coverage of national issues ranging from politics and policy to higher education and healthcare. And she led a diverse team of journalists in measuring government performance at the international, national, state, and community levels. Before joining U.S. News, she worked as a senior editor and writer at Yahoo.com, where she wrote about politics, health, career, and parenting trends, but not food, created and curated the Women in Politics section of Yahoo News. While there, she covered the First Lady's office, interviewing First Lady Michelle Obama, Dr. Jill Biden, Dr. Tina Chen, Valerie Jarrett, and other administration leaders multiple times. Before joining Yahoo, Lila spent 16 years as an editor and writer at the Boston Globe, editing at the National News, Living Arts, and Sunday Magazine departments, and writing book reviews, news features, and other content, including a parenting column for Boston.com. Next week, she returns to the Boston Globe as the editor of their Rhode Island initiative, expanding the Globe's top-notch coverage into other parts of New England. She wrote a twice-weekly column about work-life balance for workatmom.com from 2007 to 2011, and is the author of Triumph Over Discrimination, the life story of Dr. Farhang Mehr, is that how to pronounce it? Mm-hmm. In 2000, a biography of the first non-Muslim deputy prime minister of Iran. Wow. She's a frequent guest on GBH TV's Beat the Press and Greater Boston, has taught at Northeastern University, and speaks at conferences and in classrooms around the country. She earned her Bachelor of Science in Journalism from the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University, and she was inducted into their Alumni Hall of Fame in 2000. She lives outside of Boston with her husband and teenage children. So we want to welcome Lila. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. And while I don't write about food professionally online on Facebook, I share what I call cooking is cheaper than therapy because cooking is how I unwind. So I'm always either at the computer or in the kitchen. Sometimes I'm asleep. Sometimes it's all three at once, it seems. But yes, agree. Food is extremely, extremely important. So I'm going to share my screen here because I've created some slides, so it's a little easier to follow along. And we'll go with that right here. So can everyone see that? Mm-hmm. Great. So I'm so pleased to be here today to talk about democracy and the Fourth Estate and the vital role that the media plays in our democracy. And I was really pleased to hear the discussion just before this because I think you brought up a lot of great points. And some of them are things that I wanted to touch on. So this is just perfect. I'm glad we're aligned. So let's start with a brief history of the media in the United States. Journalism got its start in the United States back in 1690 in Boston with a single issue newspaper called Public Occurrences, both foreign and domestic. And the media flourished in Boston. About 100 years later in 1791, the First Amendment was ratified, protecting the freedom of the press. And news began to take a much bigger role in public life. Newspapers proliferated. News magazines were all over the place. There were weeklies and monthlies and quarterlies. And they were extremely popular through the 1800s, and especially in 1830. Up until 1830, there were mainly publications that were aimed at the super wealthy. They focused on self-improvement. They focused on enlightenment. And they were definitely geared towards people who had 35, 40, 50 cents to throw away every week. That was a lot of money then on something that really was just to make them better citizens. But after the 1830s, we began to see a shift in the general periodicals. Publications started trying to reach a broader audience, and in doing so, they focused more on entertainment than information. Now, sounds familiar? We're seeing that happen all the time, but it's not new. It's been going on since the 1830s. In 1920, radio station KDKA in Pittsburgh jumped into the news business, and that started changing the way consumers received information. All of a sudden, instead of having to go out to the street corner to buy a paper from a newsie, it was broadcast directly into your home where you could listen to it, sometimes in real time. Then there was television. It entered the news space in the 1940s and had an immediate and irrevocable impact on society. If you think about it, when the first televised presidential cycle debate happened between Vice President Nixon and Senator John F. Kennedy in 1960, it changed the way journalism and the public interact. People who listened to that debate on the radio were certain that Nixon had won. People who watched it on TV were absolutely sure that JFK was the winner. His youthfulness and his vigor came across on camera in a very different way. And Nixon's experience and his forceful speech came across on radio in a very different way. So these days, televised debates are the norm. My kids have never known a time when there was no televised debate. But back then, it was a complete game changer. And now it's become a game changer again, especially in the last two election cycles. In 2016, we saw that people were tuning in for the spectacle. They wanted to see who would get sucker punched. They wanted to see how people would react. They wanted to see what outlandish insult would be lobbed at the other candidates. And the media covered it every bit. In 1980, CNN was born, and with it, the 24/7 news cycle. MSNBC, Fox News, and others rapidly joined the party, and even the broadcast news that we'd listen to after dinner from 6 to 7 started expanding and covering other things. Just 4 years later, Yahoo launched as an internet portal where it gathered information from lots of different places, and it eventually evolved into a news hub, ushering in the online media era. To keep things local, in 1995, Boston.com was born. And just a year later, the New York Times launched their online news service, 1996. And then there was social media, which again changed the media landscape in a way that we just can't remove ourselves from. It started actually in 1999 with LiveJournal and people sharing their thoughts in a journal format online. Blogger came along in 1999 also, giving people more of a platform. You could create your own local news service there if you wanted to. LinkedIn in 2002, MySpace in 2003, Facebook in 2004, Twitter in 2006, Tumblr in 2007. More visual ones are popular now, especially among the younger set. Instagram came around in 2010, Snapchat 2011, TikTok in 2016. And as all of these different platforms have emerged, the traditional news media has adapted or adopted different procedures to reach people on those platforms. So what is the mainstream media? You may have noticed that I say traditional media a lot because I believe that the mainstream media is a myth. I think everything you can access easily from the comfort of your own home is mainstream. Generally though, when people refer to the mainstream media, they're usually referring to the big cable news networks, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, as well as to the big traditional print publications, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. But even now, alternative media is part of the mainstream. Fox News routinely claims that it's against the mainstream media, but cable viewership is up 72% over this time just a year ago, and Fox News has an average of 4.42 million viewers. That was just last week. Compare that to MSNBC at 2.75 million and CNN at 2.5 million. It's pretty obvious that all three are very firmly in the mainstream. But there's actually different types of media, and each of them target a different group, and each of them targets their different groups in different ways. broadcast and TV media. You get snippets of news with a huge emotional impact, very visual. It's very, very easy to get pulled into a story and only see one facet of it. You have radio, which can go a bit longer. You can hear a bit of people's voices, but without the visual element, it's not as much of a gut punch. You don't react to it as viscerally. You've got newspaper, which still is limited by the size of its news hole, the amount of space it can give. Print and magazine, you have longer form stories that get into a lot of depth, sometimes challenging our modern attention spans, which have not grown along with it. Online news has an infinite news hole, but there's also an infinite amount of information and misinformation that can get mixed up in there. You've got online aggregate sites like Drudge, portals like Yahoo, where you can get a vast selection of things, but algorithms tend to tell you what you end up looking at. And then, of course, there's blogging, where anyone can write anything with no oversight at any time. So we're talking about the fourth estate and the impact it has on democracy. But news media is also sometimes called the fourth branch. And I wanted to talk a little bit about those two distinctions. So the fourth estate, the idea comes from the European concept of three estates of the realm, the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners. It's been used to describe any group that's unofficial but still wields a lot of public power. So mobs have been considered the fourth estate. And I think you could probably say that social media is now too, but it usually indicates that the media is separate from, but as important as, or nearly as important as, the government. And that's the big distinction, that it's a fourth estate, not run by any of the previous three. So the fourth branch. The fourth branch comes from the American concept of government, that there's three branches, the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive. And calling the media the fourth branch implies that it's just another facet of government, controlled by it, definitely not independent of it, maybe even serving it rather than the people. So I'm sure you could decide which side of that coin I'm on, right? I believe we have a fourth estate. And I think I would argue that the fourth estate is the watchdog that holds the powerful, including the government, accountable. There's some great examples of it. The media, they're the eyes and the ears of people in the room. Ordinary citizens can't be in the White House all the time. Ordinary citizens maybe aren't at rallies or at speeches or in the off-the-record meetings. And so the media is there. It's important they can ask the questions that we all can't ask all the time, even though it seems really infuriating and even though we may not really want to be a part of it. But the media reveals the truth at its best. Without the media televising the reality of the Vietnam War, the tide may never have turned. Watergate definitely would not have been exposed. And every issue that's been identified with this current administration has been identified because of the dogged reporting by really dedicated members of the media. And I think that makes a big difference. Now, there are people who disagree. You could also make the case for the media being the fourth branch. When journalists are so concerned about access that they end up acting as mouthpieces instead of watchdogs, where they just take things at face value and share them far and wide. There's the assumption that press and PR is the same thing, and that the role of the press is simply to make a public figure look good. There's been a pivot over time away from information towards infotainment, or away from information towards confirmation of bias, which makes people feel really skeptical about what they're hearing in the news. And technology has made it possible to create videos that simply aren't true, so you can't really trust what your eyes have seen. These are called deep fakes, and photos can easily be manipulated and shared and edited, so you can't necessarily trust what you're seeing. If you take the confirmation instead of information bent, and you combine it with news outlets that preach to their own choirs, that know what their audiences want to hear and give them only that, you end up with those bubbles. And Linda, that's a little bit of what you mentioned when you wondered what you were missing with NPR. If the audience is receptive to a certain thing and they will turn on you, or you're worried they will turn on you if you bring up the things that they disagree with, The news judgment tends to tip towards just confirming, giving them what they already want to know. And so you end up with gaps in your knowledge. You end up not knowing what's going on. And you end up with a viewership or a readership that feels that the media is either for a certain cause or politician or against that certain cause or politician. There's also yellow journalism, which isn't new. It's actually, the term itself was coined by Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst in the late 1800s. And it was used to describe sensationalized or misleading news stories that both ran on purpose in order to drive up sales. And they would actually use yellow as a color to highlight those headlines to really make them eye-grabbing when the urchins with their news caps and their bundle of news would stand on the corner hawking the newspaper. So outrageous, believable, but false news has existed long before our current age in the media. But then people used to have to go out of their way to find it. You had to find that particular vendor and buy that particular paper. And now, though, it comes to us directly over TV, cable news, social media, the internet, and yes, even in certain publications. And then we have bias. So bias exists. I truly don't believe there's a truly unbiased news source out there, though some are trying to avoid bias more than others. Part of the reason for that is all news decisions are made by people, and people are inherently biased towards certain things. It's part of how they're brought up. It's part of what they bring to the table. And it goes far beyond race, though that term is, bias is often a term we hear now when we're talking about race and ethnicity. But humans make judgment calls, and human judgment is never foolproof. What I've shared here is a media bias chart by Ad Fontes Media. It started in 2018 by Vanessa Ortario, who's an attorney in Denver, Colorado. I'll share the link to it here in case you want to explore it. There's an interactive version also, or maybe I'll share the link at the end when I can get back to my, back to the chat. So I'll be sure to add it in the chat. But if you look there, if you can see it, you'll see a cluster in the center. The one at the top of the chart in all ways is AP. They tend to just report what's going on. Not a lot of analysis, no opinion. And that makes for the least biased source. PBS is up there also. The Weather Channel, oddly enough, is up there. And several broadcast but not cable sources. The cable sources you'll see more in the middle, where they have very reliable news coverage for the most part, but there's definitely more of a left lean or a right lean. Towards the bottom, in the less reliable category, you've got sites that peddle in conspiracy theories. You've got sites that peddle in propaganda. These are not all the RT, the Russian Today sites that maybe we heard a lot about a few years ago. These are sites that have become very, very mainstream. Palmer Report leans far to the left. News Punch, which is maybe a little more obscure, but InfoWars, we've definitely heard a lot about over the last 4 years, leads far to the right. And so whether or not you're filling all the holes in your coverage mainly has to do with where you're getting your news from. I would recommend that people get their news from as many different sources as they have time for, because in spite of, 6 months of listening to Rush Limbaugh can be really tough. But as you pointed out, you learned a lot about what you didn't know, but it is still hard to tell what the truth is. The truth is always somewhere in the middle. If you're getting sources in the middle, but also from the left and the right, you'll get a better sense of not just what's out there, but what people are believing and how that changes what you find out about next. Why don't we pause here? Does anyone have any questions or any thoughts about where they are in the fourth estate versus fourth branch question? And since I can't see the chat, I'll rely on Kama or Linza to let me know if there are any questions in there.
Mary Margaret, yeah. We have nothing in the chat right now, Lila.
All right, we'll keep going then.
I have a question.
Sure.
Where is the real news?
Depends on what you decide is real. And a lot of people have different definitions.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, the site that's called The Real News. Maybe I'm using the wrong name.
Oh, is it for the chart itself, or is it one of the?
It should be on the chart, but I just don't see the real news. Oh,
I don't think the chart is comprehensive because there's so many different out there. But there are other websites that try to compile information or at least try to flag false news sites and conspiracy sites. Mm-hmm. So I can try to look that up for you afterwards.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm curious, Elizabeth Wilson, do you have your hand up or are you blocking the sun? I don't know if you have a question or you're blocking the sun, I think. Okay. That's fine. Marianne?
Yeah, I don't exactly know how to ask this question, but I think of the news as the fourth estate, as something separate and necessary, separate from government and necessary. But today, I'm concerned because of the amount, the control of news media is in the hands of big corporations, of corporations having an impact on government and vice versa, and the motivation seeming to be bottom line financial. And how is that affecting where the media is today in terms of whether they're a separate estate or a branch of government?
That's a great question. I touch on that a little bit in the next section, but also I think there's a popular thought that every single part of the media is controlled by big corporations, but people aren't sure what those corporations are, whether they're news corporations, whether they're venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. There are certain publications that aren't. The Boston Globe, for example, is not controlled by a big corporation. It used to be owned by the New York Times. It's now owned locally by John Henry, who owns the Red Sox. Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, who does own Amazon, though it's run separately. He's very hands-off about it. He's concerned about the business side. Marty Baron from Boston Globe fame runs the news operations, and he's as steady as they come. U.S. News and World Report is independently owned. There are other publications that also are, but for the most part, the organizations that do own media aren't necessarily lobbying the government for things. They're not big oil. They're not big pharma. They're not biotech. They're not those kind of corporate firms. So what's confusing, though, is that the focus on the bottom line really has impacted the news that you consume. Because back in the day, were able to generate plenty of income by selling ads. And then that evaporated as online media took over and advertisers could reach people for pennies on the dollar. So the focus shifted a bit and the way they covered news shifted a bit and the audience expectations shifted a bit. So again, I would urge people to look to multiple sources to find out what the news is and what's really going on. And it's important to keep in mind that news is still a business. And so, so the altruistic factor of informing people sometimes isn't top of mind. There's a great example of that going on right now, actually. Tonight's debate, which was canceled and is no longer a debate, instead of having one network run an hour-long town hall with Biden and then an hour-long town hall with Trump, you've got two different networks running two separate town halls at the same time. That doesn't serve the viewership. It makes it incumbent on the viewer to try to record one town hall, to invest twice as much time in watching so they can suss out what's going on. There's no way to compare and contrast. There's no way to hear the same two different candidates answer the same question in two different ways. But each network has an exclusive. Each network will get a viewership. Each network is hoping to increase their bottom line, and the viewers themselves are kind of left behind, in my opinion. I'm going to go to the next slide because that's a great segue into it. And it's talking about how technology has changed the media, whether we've changed for the better or for the worse. And the technology has helped the media take massive leaps forward, but also backwards. So on the upside, for the better, we have better access. Journalists have better access to public records, which means they can create better informed, more in-depth stories. More news can be disseminated more easily. There are ways to share it and to reach a larger audience if you could figure out the magic equation of what's interesting to them and what you're able to produce. There's better access for the readers to past coverage. If you read a story and it's interesting and you don't know what it's based on, you don't know the background, you don't know the stories that came before, you can find those things pretty easily, either on that news site itself or using Google's Wayback Machine, which takes snapshots of every website out there at various points in time. You can dig through online archives that have been digitized instead of having to make a call to the newspaper and hope there's a back issue or to hope your local library saved those back issues. Email has changed reporting in a lot of ways. You can reach sources now who maybe you weren't able to reach before, and sometimes that informs your story for the better. Journalists can crowdsource using social media, especially Twitter. Crowdsourcing is putting out a question and gathering lots and lots of information back, interacting with both other journalists and also news consumers. It's way more efficient than ringing a bell in the public square and shouting out your question, which is really how sometimes it was done before. There's the ability to promote and share news widely in an instant. I think one of the biggest advantages to technology is that it's much more difficult for governments to hide news events. The Arab Spring would never have been covered in the same way without Twitter. Using Facebook to locate your loved ones after the earthquake in Haiti, that wouldn't have been able to happen. You wouldn't have been able to share news in real time about what was actually going on the ground. And it also gives journalists the ability to interact with their readers and maybe get a better sense of what readers and viewers really want rather than preaching at them from on high. There was a point in time during my career where if I wrote something and then it was printed, I never knew the audience reaction to it. I didn't know if people wanted more. I didn't know if I had offended someone. I didn't know if I had missed something unless an editor noticed. Nowadays in the comments, which sometimes I regret reading, but sometimes they're great, you can get immediate feedback about whether you've missed something. And sometimes the follow-up story is right there in your discussion with your readers. Now, there's always a downside, right? So the downside is that everyone and anyone can put out what they decide is news with no oversight. And so people with no journalism training end up sharing false information or starting rumors. And those rumors spread because people want to hear something that confirms their worldview. So if they want to believe that gigantic lizards are really taking over government, there's something out there that will confirm that for them, whether it's true or not, and they can share it. Part of the problem with the corporatization of media is that big media and traditional media is compelled to be first, sometimes letting accuracy slide. And that need to be first is the need to grab as many viewers as possible. Sometimes that's advertising driven, but sometimes it's just so you can tell people your numbers are bigger, so you can give your payouts to your shareholders, and so you can promote the business of news. Another downside, so many fake news sites, just so many. And unless you're a very savvy reader or consumer, it's difficult to tell them apart. There's a fake news site that is spoofing NBC News. But it's NBCAU.com or NBC, and then there's some other extra letters in there. But it's stolen the logo, it's got the same look. It's very difficult to tell it's not news. And then you've got real legitimate news sources promoting satire or opinion online, and people can't tell it's satire. I love reading Andy Borowitz in New York Magazine, but it's satire. The Onion is a great example. Sometimes there's a little too much truth and humor, but The Onion is still a fake news site. There's another one called Freewood Post. Check the About page and see if it tells you who's behind it. See if it mentions that it's satire. Most places have to disclose that somewhere, and that can be a good tip to figure out if what you're reading is real or fake. But another problem with technology is there's a focus on style over substance. a lot of the TV stations in Miami, for example, have gone all flashy and flashbangy with, you know, images whizzing past you and video montages and bright lights. And there's so much focus on jazzing up the look that you forget there's no substance there. That brings me to reality TV. Staged photo ops replacing actual news events or actual news briefings where they're used to just present an idea with no discussion. Technology has made that easier too. And of course, the deep fake videos and deceptively edited photos that make you doubt what your eyes are actually seeing. So, democracy. The technological advances have changed how consumers access and share the news, but it's also changed how news gets presented and produced. And in some cases, it's changed what news gets produced and presented at all. And this has become really clear, at least to me, especially when it comes to political coverage. The news you get depends largely on whether you're logging in, tuning in, or signing into social media, as well as which sites or publications you're looking at. Believe it or not, most adults actually get their news from social media, mostly Facebook, where because they trust the people they've networked with, their friends and their family and their coworkers, they trust what those people are sharing, even if what they're sharing isn't actually news. But social media, I don't consider it part of the media because there's little regulation and enforcement. Another great example of that happened this week when Twitter removed a false story that was being shared by Republicans in the administration, but Facebook allowed it to stand and just limited its reach while they fact check, even though it was patently false. On social media, people mix up the idea of freedom of speech and freedom from consequences, which are two very, very different things. You are free to say whatever you want, but that doesn't mean that a private platform like Twitter, I don't mean private in that it's secure. I mean private in that it's not owned by the public. It's a privately owned company, can technically decide what they want to allow you to share at all. It, just because you're able to share it doesn't always mean you should and doesn't always mean you should be allowed to. On social media also, memes, those little visual things with jokes in it or pithy statements, allow people to minimize the content and maximize the emotional impact or the outrage. There's short video clips, satire, and opinion. All of that is thrown together on the same platform and taken at face value and shared as if they were actual news. So as we mentioned a moment ago, the business of the media has changed completely over the years. You've gone from display and classified advertising being the main source of revenue. So news media opened up news sites with that were free or that mirrored their print publication. People got used to getting their information for free and now balk at getting a subscription to good content, which means that news is at a loss for income. What's happening then are the owners are slashing the staff. They're trying to make them wring every dollar out of the company, sometimes to the point where there's so little information at the publication that the property the offices are built on has more value than the business itself. You can get your breaking news anywhere. You hear it on the radio. You get it on your phone in an instant. It's in your inbox, in your email. It's at the bottom of your TV screen when there's breaking news, even if you're watching a different show. So the media, in order to stay in business, has to come up with different ways to get funding. Some of them have done this by reaching out to corporations, but more often to foundations like the Solution Journalism Network, Robert Wood Johnson, and other foundations to underwrite certain parts of their coverage, to subsidize it in a way, but they don't have any sort of input into the content. Other forms of intense competition on online and cable has just led to a deterioration of quality and a pivot away from serving the public. There's more clickbait out there, getting you to click on a quick little blurb that actually doesn't contain much more than what you saw when you clicked. There are algorithms on news sites designed to serve up more of what you've already shown an interest in, which generates a really thick bubble around you. At Yahoo, there was an algorithm that helped decide what would go on the front page. Only one portion of it, a little carousel at the top, was curated by humans. The rest in the stream below that depended on what you had clicked on in the past. We called this, when I worked there, the phenomenon of Kim Kardashian's backside, because people would click on stories about what Kim Kardashian had worn and how revealing it was. And the next time they logged in, there would be more stories about what Kim Kardashian wore and how revealing it was, till all of a sudden your entire feed was, since Yahoo pulled in news from different sources, you'd have a People magazine story about Kim Kardashian, followed by an Us magazine story about Kim Kardashian, followed by a Star magazine story about Kim Kardashian, followed by a blog post where, so the first thing you'd see would be five or six articles all about the same dress that this one celebrity wore. So they've adjusted things since then, and other news organizations do things a little differently, but there's still a danger that because you've clicked on stories about Trump, your newsfeed will then be filled with mainly stories about Trump when you really should be hearing about other things as well. There's also been a focus on exclusive at the expense of actual information. You see that sometimes when you see a book excerpt from a public figure, and maybe the information in the book would have served the public if it had been broadcast or shared immediately, like the idea that the coronavirus was being downplayed. But instead it's saved and it's shared later when the news source that's sharing it can get a bump in traffic from it or can sell other content around it. So we talk a lot about media bias and about partisan politics. But it's worth remembering that there was a time when the press was not expected to be nonpartisan. They were not expected to be unbiased. In the 1800s and 1900s, people assumed that the publication they were reading reflected the opinions of their publishers, and they were correct. In 1861, federal officials actually identified newspapers that supported the Confederate cause and shut them down. And that was not outrageous at all. In the 19th century, cities typically had multiple newspapers, I mean more than two, reporting and supporting the various political factions within a party, not just the political parties themselves. Over the last 150 years or so, Boston has had as many as 56 newspapers at the same time, each advocating for different causes and constituents. From small papers that came out once a month, like The Heathen Woman's Friend, which was a missionary Christian publication, to The Globe and The Herald and The Evening Advocate and The Daily Advocate and The Evening Telegram and The Evening Sunday Telegram and The Boston Evening Telegram, all of which were different publications, all of which had voracious readerships. So, it's pretty clear that for me, a trustworthy, objective, independent press is essential to democracy. I think that debate is healthy and important. I think that getting multiple points of view is extremely important. But trust in traditional media has diminished over time. In 1956, an American National Election Study found that 78% of Republicans and 64% of Democrats thought newspapers were fair. By 1997, so just 40 years later, a generation later, Gallup polls noted that most Americans did not trust the media to report the news fully, accurately, or fairly. By 2004, the Chronicle of Higher Education found that only about 10% of Americans said they had a great deal of confidence in a national news media. Local news still has more dedication, more loyalty, and more trust than the national news. By 2013, 78% of conservatives now say mass media is biased, and 44% of liberals and 50% of moderates said the same. By 2016, according to Gottfried and Shearer, which also conducts these kind of polls, 62% of U.S. adults get their news from social media rather than the mainstream traditional media, and Facebook is the most dominant social media news site. 2017, a Gallup poll found that most Americans assumed the news media favored a particular party. 64% of most people believe it favors Democrats, and 22% still say it favors Republicans. And most recently, in August, Pew Research found that no more than half of Americans say they feel confident about the media that they see. Another issue, objectivity, like beauty, is often in the eye of the beholder. It's getting better, but in general, newsrooms rarely reflect the demographics of the communities they cover, and that changes what news you see, because the people deciding what's important don't necessarily reflect the race, socioeconomic, age, education level of the people who they're trying to get to buy their product. The idea of objectivity itself has actually come under fire for being inherently biased. Two-time Pulitzer-winning reporter Wesley Lowery, who worked for The Globe and then Washington Post and is now at NBC News, recently wrote in the New York Times that instead of focusing on being fair and telling the truth, journalists are often forced to focus on avoiding offense, and that the people they're trying to avoid offending are usually affluent and usually white. So I'm going to, rather than read you his entire article, which is worth a read, I'm going to dump this into the chat. I can find it here. Oh, again, I'm going to have to put it. Oh, there it is. Let me dump that in here for you. And this should be outside of the paywall, so you should be able to see this. So, and then the independence of the press itself, which is so integral to having a watchdog, a free and independent press, is also being undermined or at least manipulated by a whole host of people, by lawmakers and politicians who slam unfavorable coverage as fake, by readers who ironically decry the fake news media while consuming and believing reports that are actually fake, by public figures who stage events that are covered as if they were actually newsworthy, whether that's an award show or whether that's a book signing, or whether it's just the paparazzi following the Kardashians around in public. These things are magnified until they seem like they're news, even when they're not. It's being undermined in some ways by the media itself. Outlets that try to provide the readers and viewers with stories that conform and confirm their worldview rather than challenging them. Owners that have shaved newsrooms down to the bone, leaving a few staffers to cover a vast array of stories, sacrificing accuracy, and context and depth. All of these things are whittling away at the independence and the strength of the media. So personally, I think that when you look at the news now, in order to preserve democracy, I think the fourth estate needs to adapt. I think that early on in these election cycles, the media failed to acknowledge that the push to elect a businessman could mean that the norms of how we cover politics would change or be ignored. In business, your PR team is your media team, and they're there to make you look good. They're there to deal with crisis messaging, to neutralize crises, to develop internal communications and then align them with what your business representative will say externally, usually to shareholders and to stakeholders, not to constituents. You don't serve in business, you don't serve your customers as much as you earn money for your shareholders and stakeholders. Bringing that to government, I don't think the media was ready to think about what that could mean. The deep mistrust of the press by government officials is only matched or exceeded by the deep mistrust of the press by business people who don't want you to look under the hood. And I think we've seen that reflected here with the lack of access that we've had to the truth from this particular administration, but also leading up to this. The Obama administration was wonderful in a lot of ways, but giving the press access, that's not one of them. The media also failed to adapt once the election was over. Reporters are trained to report what's going on without injecting themselves into the story. I spent years in journalism school being taught how to be a fly on the wall, to look at things and just flatly say them as they happened without injecting my own opinion. Reality TV, though, is about selling a storyline. It's about presenting information the way you want it to be presented and then working frantically to make it come true. Trump used this to his advantage, and the viewers watched the spectacle, and the media reported it, presented it, and were excited to see their numbers skyrocket because more and more people tuned in or purchased subscriptions or logged in. There wasn't enough skepticism early on, I think. And instead, the bar kept getting lowered until finally the idea of a person acting like a person, the president acting presidential, became newsworthy when really it shouldn't have been. Old tropes about power versus strength and likability versus relatability came up during the election cycle leading up to that. Those are some things that female candidates have seen over and over. But the news media seemed to flip a switch and go back to those tropes early on. You saw that in the vice presidential debates, where the main criticism that certain analysts could come up with for Kamala Harris was that she used too many expressions. It's something that gets leaned on. It's an older way of doing things when women weren't supposed to be the focus of these kind of political stories. And I'm disappointed to see that reporters keep going back to that. We've got a reporter now at the New York Times, a fashion reporter, whose sole job is to report on what the Supreme Court justice candidate is wearing each day. That wouldn't happen if that candidate was male. It's a great example of the media kind of going back to old biases, going back to tired old tropes, and not adapting for what their readers want now. Journalists were also used to the idea that the White House is a reliable primary news source. You could believe what you heard in a press conference. And anonymous sources were fine. Deep Throat, no one questioned Deep Throat, or at least no one who was dedicated to exposing Watergate was going to question Deep Throat. The unnamed news sources, the reporters still know who they are. When they say it's a senior White House official, they know who they're talking to at that press conference or that phone conference, but they know they can't name that person and attribute a quote to them. These were all very standard, and these standards were thrown out the window in a lot of ways as the media tried to play by the old rules, and the current politicians were generating new rules. The old rules only work when everyone's abiding by them. And if the old rules aren't working, it's important to question why and to see what else you can report. I think, though, that there's hope. I see news media catching on. I see a return to the old-fashioned shoe leather reporting that brought us the spotlight investigation into the Catholic Church. I see a lot more data visualization, a lot more data journalism, where they're really digging into the numbers and saying, hey, this doesn't jibe. What's going on here? What else can I find out? There's a closer look at the laws and whether they're being adhered to. Reporters are going back a bit into relying on their own work and their own analysis and less on what they're just being told by certain people high up the food chain. And I also think you're seeing it in the news you consume on television. You've got Chyrons fact-checking in real time. You've got news networks putting out fact checks as debates go on, that you hit refresh on your computer as you're watching the debate, and you find out whether something was accurate or not. And the big traditional media has finally started calling a lie instead of debating about whether it was intended to be a lie or not. And so I'm hoping that what I'll see next as we enter into 2021 is more of that. I would love to see more accuracy. I would love to see more of a focus on not just entertaining people with information, but having them learn something. But people need to be open to it. And while people may not still quite trust the media, I think people are becoming more concerned and more discerning about their sources. We're more likely to call out friends on social media who have shared something that's patently false. We're more willing to call a lie a lie. We're more willing to look at multiple sources to figure out what's going on, to tune into a show we normally wouldn't listen to find out where our own knowledge gaps are, and then find a way to fill them. And so that's where I am. I am so pleased to have been here today. Thank you so much. You can find out more about me. LilaMAlphonse.com is not been updated quite recently, but it's where I tend to collect my appearances and my thoughts and whatever's in my notebook that doesn't make it into a story. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook, and I look forward to seeing you online. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Could you thank you. I wanted you to open the screen.
There we are.
So that means it's almost 1 o'clock. We have still some time just to direct questions to Lila, because this is her hour, and then we'll open it up to the whole group, including Dorianne, and questions that might come her way too.
Great.
Hello.
I think I see Edward and Mary Rose have questions, but I'll leave it to Linda to moderate.
Yeah, go ahead, Edward. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, hi. One of the aspects of the media is the consolidation of it. In 1996 under Clinton, and also 2003 under Bush, the consolidation of the media went from like 100 different independent sources to half a dozen. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you could explain what effect that had on our news. And then maybe could you talk about other countries, how their news is brought out, like, mm-hmm. for instance, in Britain they have the BBC, which is a separate organization, supposedly independent of the government. I'm just wondering what some comments about those things.
Sure, those are both great questions. I think the consolidation of news has been pretty detrimental in a lot of ways, maybe less so on the national level, but definitely at the local level. I think what you're seeing now in a lot of places, especially smaller towns in the exurbs, the suburbs of the suburbs, I think you're seeing news deserts develop where people aren't getting access to the news that actually affects their day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. School committee meetings are really boring, but they're really important. And people just, we don't have reporters at those meetings, at town hall meetings, at community meetings where the decisions that affect you in your own home are actually being made. At the national level, I think what you're seeing is a lot of repetition. You're seeing, I'll call it the USA Today effect, though that's unofficial. You see one major corporation owning multiple satellite papers and sharing that content throughout different regions, whether it applies to those regions or not, just to fill space. And to make it look like there's more substantial news out there with a very, very small skeleton crew. So I think what happens then is you end up with people filling the gaps from unreliable sources. And then as a society, we become less and less and less informed. In other countries, I haven't worked in other countries, so my experience is not firsthand. It's more academic. But yes, the BBC is independent of the government, though subsidized in some ways by it. And even they're experiencing cuts and consolidation because everywhere, everyone is trying to figure out how to make this new business model work. In other countries like India, you can pay money and have a favorable news story put on the front page. Just depends how much you're willing to pay and if you know the right people. I say that with some experience. My grandmother was a member of parliament in India. I saw her get trashed in the media for not paying for good coverage. Which was kind of appalling. You have coverage in countries where the news is not news. It is propaganda. It is vetted. It is controlled. I'm thinking North Korea. I'm thinking Russia, where even though the news media is presented as independent, there is an agenda and you hew to it or you are punished for it. Mm-hmm. And then there's places in between where people are trying to paint a rosy picture of what's going on while investigative reporters are trying to root out corruption, while war correspondents are trying to show you the reality of what's happening and bring those news stories home so that people who aren't directly affected by it can still get a sense of how it matters. But I think it really differs from country to country. A lot depends on resources and a lot depends on a host of other factors, from religion to politics to what consumers themselves want to see and whether they're able to actually access those sites online, whether there are restrictions or whether the press is truly free.
And I think Linda was, did you have your hand up?
Mm-hmm.
No.
I did.
Who
I
else?
Did.
Oh, Mary Rose, sorry.
The other night, I never watch Fox News at all and probably should. But I turned it on for 1 minute, and they had an array of doctors,
one from Harvard Medical School, and he was telling a very different story about the pandemic, about mask wearing, and about children of particular ages not really being big transmitters of the virus. And I didn't listen for more than 2 minutes, and I thought, oh my God. And if he really was an immunologist from Harvard, how could he have such a different opinion compared to all the doctors we see every day, from Tony Fauci to, you know, NIH, all the, what we think of as experts. I just find that very scary. And I don't know how you would go about finding more information. You know, where would you go from? And I'm a nurse. I mean, I'm skeptical anyway and all that, but what do you do with that kind of information?
That's a great example of the confirmation versus information problem that I see out there. Harvard is vast. There are lots and lots of different experts who work there. Try hard enough, you'll find someone who can confirm pretty much anything you want to write a story about.
Okay.
So the doctor that you've mentioned, I think, was involved in the Great Barrington Declaration that's been making the news lately. A group of doctors, notably, it's only one from a handful of very revered institutions, and then a lot of other names that you won't recognize from places you might not recognize, that basically say, open up society, whoever's going to get sick gets sick, herd immunity will help
us. Herd immunity, okay.
And the issue with that is you can't undo a shutdown. It's already happened, so you need to figure out how to rebuild from it. But there's no evidence yet that people gain enough immunity, strong enough or long-term enough immunity from this virus for herd immunity to actually be a thing. That does not jibe with what that network's viewers want to hear. So they find someone who will confirm the things that they want to hear, because having, and I'm using Fox as an example because that's the one we're discussing. CNN does this too. And MSNBC does this too. And lots of other places do this too. You find the source who will support your argument rather than find, or you find one that supports and one that disagrees with your argument rather than acknowledging that there are many, many different sides to every single story. So in this case, they found someone who would say that masks are really difficult to breathe in, and you know, if everyone else around you isn't sick, you really don't need to wear one. We have a real life example of that's not true. There's a delay between the test results and the day you were actually tested. And during that time, you can test something. You can test negative multiple times while in isolation and still suddenly test positive, because your viral load is not high enough to be detected yet, but that doesn't mean you're not contagious. We've got, you know, a ground zero going on right now in the middle of Washington, D.C., because someone believed that if they're not sick and if everyone around them is tested, then no one will ever get sick. So even though that's been disproven, there's still this drive to convince people that you don't really have to do these things that you don't want to do simply because it's more important to have the economy up and running. I'm not saying it's not important to have the economy up and running. I'm just saying that maybe allowing people to get horribly sick when you don't know the long-term outcomes is not the best way to, it's not the best trade-off. As for what you can do about it, it goes back to the getting your news from multiple sources. So the Great Barrington Declaration has a very smooth, slick-looking, beautiful-looking website. Looks very authoritative. A good thing to do is plug in Great Barrington Declaration into Google and see which news articles come out, and then pick four of them. One from one side, one from the other side, two in the middle, and see what they have to say. The problem with making it incumbent on the news consumer to do all that is we don't all have time. We're working jobs, we're raising families, we're running households, we're trying desperately to stay relatively sane right now in the middle of a pandemic and a crazy news cycle and a crazy election. There's so much going on that taking a couple of hours to decide for yourself whether what you just saw on TV is the real thing, it's exhausting. And I kind of think that for the people who are trying to push the false narrative, that's the point. If you're too exhausted to check, then they can say whatever you want and you'll either believe them or you'll have turned it off. And if you turned it off, they're not trying to reach you anyway. So I would advocate for taking just a few minutes to take what you've heard with a few grains of salt, healthy dose of skepticism, and see what people are saying about it, see what the analysis is. You'll find out that, for example, for this particular declaration, one of the doctors' names of the doctors who signed it is IP Freely, and another one is I Am Fake. And so, especially if it's something that's thrown open to the public, sign here, show your support. Your best bet would be to doubt that at least half of those signatures are actually real signatures, because anyone can sign anything with any name. But it is, I want to acknowledge again how exhausting this is, because it really takes a toll. And then your own internal conversation or narrative starts going, am I really at risk? Not just for the pandemic. Is it really terrible out there? Are there really riots down the street? What is it really this group against that group? Or is there a third group that's just taking advantage of the chaos? It's up to us as news consumers largely to decide what's going on in our world. And the best thing we can do, especially not everyone's trained to be a journalist, is to seek out sources you trust. I did say that I would share that anti-bias chart link. And let me do that before I forget, because it's a good starting point for figuring out whether the news outlet you're looking at is a legitimate one, and if it's where it falls on the spectrum, and how you can balance it out by looking for something in another part of that spectrum. So there's the link to that in the group chat.
Thank you, Lila. I have a question about this then. So how obvious, like if I'm Fox News and I want to run a story that is a confirmation story about what I already want to sell, how blatant am I about, do I run an advertisement and say, I want an immunologist that will back me up? Or do the immunologist who believes in me call me? Am I, if people like giving themselves to the news story, or how do I find this collection of people who are going to be confirming my point of view?
Oh, great question. That process is different for each reporter and each network. In general, reporters have their Rolodex, whether it's virtual or an actual physical Rolodex, of people who they've networked with, who they've come in contact with at conferences, who have emailed them, who have written letters, who have published studies, and they reach out to them. Sometimes if there's a source that wants to amplify their point of view, they'll reach out to the reporter and offer a story. PR people pitch their clients all the time with specific angles that they want the reporters to explore with their client. They can make it feel like the reporter is figuring it out for themselves, but it's been engineered all along.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm hearing.
It's really interesting, all the behind the scenes machinations of getting a story out there. And when you've got a staff that's already been trimmed down to bare bones, where you used to have 100 reporters and then you had 70 reporters and now you have 50 reporters who are trying to put out more content than you did when you have 100, it's very easy to take that press release and pull a few of the quotes from the press release, or make that one phone call to that one source who constantly emails you, and there you go. And not confirm it and not get additional sourcing. And you end up providing the story that maybe your readers or viewers want to see because they already believe it, but it might not be really what's serving the public well. And that really is not exclusive to Fox News. One big reason why you see the same set of experts all the time on all the media and all the news reports is because reporters who are pressed for time will see who acted as a source for someone else and then call them too. Mm-hmm. You end up then with the same voices over and over and over and over, just in different media.
So the more challenged our news is, the more journalists we're losing, and the more journalists we're losing, the more challenging the news is.
It's a vicious cycle. It's a vicious catch-22 in a lot of ways.
Wow. Thank you.
Luckily, you're welcome. Luckily, there's a rising generation of journalists that are still bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and dedicated to finding the truth. I've seen it among my students. I've seen it among my interns.
Good.
and they are not discouraged. They are, and they grew up skeptical. That's one thing that's both infuriating and admirable about my teenagers and young adults, children. It's weird thinking of them as young adults, but they're in their mid and late 20s now, so I have to admit it. But they're skeptical by nature. They don't believe everything that they're seeing. They want, if they don't believe it and you can't adequately back yourself up, they'll look for someone who can or something that can. So they're bringing that skepticism back into the newsroom. And I'm really glad to see it coming back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks for the message of hope. Now we're into our 1 o'clock discussion session. So please, if you have anything you want to discuss about Dorianne's talk or Lila's talk or in any about the media, please raise your hand. I can't see all the hands, so I think I'm going to leave it to Mary Margaret to call on people because we have too many people for one screen.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. So Mary Margaret, will you call on people?
I'll try to catch the hands and watch the chat. I see a hand, Barbara Valandry.
So my question is, with this new media cycle and what has happened, how do these foreign players that are trying to influence our election, it seems like that's a ready cycle for them. How do they impact us?
So what's interesting is they've actually been here for a while, at least 10 years. Social media has really given them an entryway. They don't need to now convince a journalist to cover their story or take their press release or their call. They just throw up a Facebook page and people find it and agree with it and share it and amplify it. The thing about social media is I dislike it in a lot of ways, but I also have to remind myself that it's a tool and I get to choose how to use it. I get to choose whether I'm going to limit my group to just people I know in real life, or whether I'm going to interact with strangers who seem only out to piss me off. It's like the way I explained it to someone once was, I'm not going to throw out my microwave just because I can also use it to make junk food. It depends on how you're going to use it. I can stick a tray of cookies in the oven. I do that all the time, but I can also make a roast chicken and feed my family something healthy and nutritious. But I mean, meringues are nice too, so I do that as well. It all depends on how you're using your tool, whether you're using it to find information that you agree with, so you can throw it in someone else's face, whether you're using it to broaden your worldview, whether you're using it to reinforce your bubble, so you can just stay connected with the cousins who you normally wouldn't talk to at all. There are lots of different uses for it. Unfortunately, one of the uses is that anyone anywhere else in the world can use a VPN and make their account seem like it's based in one country where they're not and start bringing out information that can influence an election, because they're not necessarily, if their goal is to destabilize, you can destabilize in a lot of ways without ever revealing who you're really working for. You can go into the middle of a Black Lives Matter discussion and talk about rioting without talking about who's doing it. You can go into the middle of a discussion about feminism and start talking about feminazis without talking about what's really going on, or equality or opportunity, and instead take on and amplify grievances. There are ways to do that, and people react emotionally instead of objectively. They react defensively. And you've achieved your goal. You've destabilized them. They're off their footing. They're not willing to be rational anymore. Now they're willing to amplify your message and destabilize other people. It grows. It mushrooms. But those players have been there for a long time. The U.S. is one of those players in other countries in a lot of ways. Propaganda is not exclusive to countries outside of the U.S. And it's not necessarily about themselves. The U.S. propaganda campaigns, CIA-run campaigns, in other countries in the 60s weren't necessarily about making the U.S. look good. It was about achieving a goal. So that's been going on all the time. When you go to Russia, there are museums now for that show old propaganda. In parts of China, you can see old posters collected in places. But these things have just changed. They've shifted media. They've gone from being posters and being radio reports and the newsreels that play before movies to being Facebook pages and Twitter accounts that are run by people in shadowy places that are hard to trace.
Lindsay, there's a question in the chat. What about Russia infiltrating our media for influencing the election? How do we know?
That's a tough question to answer. I would argue that Russia hasn't I can never pronounce that word. There you go. Our traditional mainstream media, the ones that are run by actual journalists who have training and actual editors who hold them accountable. I would argue, though, that because a lot of people assume that social media is part of the media, that reality TV is part of the media, that opinion and satire are also part of the media, that it's easy to conflate what foreign actors are doing in general to affect the public with what the media is doing themselves. There are Russian-owned and Russian-influenced news sources. The biggest one out there is called RT, which stands for Russia Today, though they don't use that branding anymore because they rebranded as a conservative-focused site. They never actually say they're based in the U.S., though they do have U.S. correspondents. They do have legitimate journalists working for them, but they do also have influence. I mean, they're subsidized by the Russian government.
Wow. Do we have any other comments or questions, Edward? Oh, I think you're muted.
Oh, sorry. Okay. You brought up RT. One of the things that journalists on RT have to do now is they have to be registered as Russian agents. Mm-hmm. And several of the programs on RT are made in America. Larry King has to be now, he has a program on it, and he has to be registered as a Russian agent, just to point out. And there are a lot of programs that are on RT that are not allowed on NPR or not allowed on public broadcasting that give a liberal view. Just to point that out.
No, it's absolutely true. It's not, RT is one example, but it's not one political party or another.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing you brought up, the fact that using Google to look up other sources. Mm-hmm. Back in the days of the Iraq War, for instance, I could Google, let's say, Niger and yellow cake, and I would get stories that were all over the place. Some sources that were like Guardian magazine, Guardian newspaper, and Common Dreams. Mm-hmm. And I would get an assortment, and I could actually find where the Bush government was lying. Mm-hmm. If I do that today, there's fact-checking done by groups like Google and Facebook. They hire groups called, I think, the Atlantic Council, which are populated by military people and have a mindset that they solve problems by using military force. So how can I trust Google and things like this to check my facts?
So I would suggest that Google is yet another tool. And so it's important to take your evaluation one step further and look at the sites Google is suggesting you go to. There are independent or more independent, maybe not completely independent, sites out there. Factcheck.org is one. Snopes is another, though I know it's often accused of having a liberal bias. ProPublica is not government run, and they do some amazing investigative reporting. Let me add some of these into here. Snopes. ProPublica.org, FactCheck.org. So those are the sites I tend to go to first when I'm trying to fact check something. The Washington Post and the New York Times have been doing a great job with their political fact checking, but if you're looking for something much broader, they don't have the time or the resources to fact check everything all the time and to keep a running up-to-date database of those things. But those three sites do a better job of it, and that can be helpful.
The one other thing, if you go back to 2002 or 2003, it was the New York Times and the Washington Post that actually published Reasons to Go to War, and mm-hmm. and that was a major effect on the public.
That's a great example of how the Fourth Estate really does impact politics and the public. You have Maggie Haberman right now at the New York Times is often accused of just trying to preserve her own access to the administration. It's easy to forget that the same reporter who broke the Clinton email story has broken a lot of the same Trump stories. For them, it's not so much about getting one politician or one political party. It's about digging. It's about trying to find out what's really going on under the surface. And oftentimes real trained journalists with real trained editors are doing that regardless of who is in power.
Lila, what's the most accurate site for election information, polling, or those kind of things? Is there one you would recommend?
Not Rasmussen. So I wouldn't recommend them. They tend to lean so heavily to one side as to skew pretty much everything, and they're usually an outlier when compared to others. I go with Gallup and with Pew. But it's important to remember when you look at poll data that a poll is a snapshot in time. And it's a snapshot in time of a certain part of the publication, of the population. Yep. Even if they reach a high enough number of people for the sample to be representative of the country statistically, they're still, if it's conducted by phone, by landline, they're missing all the people who have eliminated their landlines and only use their cell phones.
Yeah.
If it's conducted online, they're missing a whole generation of people who don't use the internet that way, plus a whole segment of the population that doesn't have high-speed internet access.
Right.
They're doing it only between 9 and 5. They're missing the people who are at their offices and can't take the call. If they're doing it only at night, they're missing the segment of the population that works nights, maybe in the blue-collar sector, maybe in the service sector, whose opinions are still important but often go unheard. So I would suggest taking several different polls and looking for the fine print. Look at the margin of error, look at how the poll was conducted, and look at when the poll was conducted, because the data could have been gathered a month ago, but if it's coming out now, it's not necessarily reflecting what's going on now.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
Here's a piece of another question. What about independent producers who make YouTube political issue pieces?
Those are always suspect to me, because anyone can be an independent producer. Anyone can put anything on YouTube, and YouTube waits until they have enough complaints before they fact check something or take it down. So you'll end up with slickly produced, beautiful looking documentaries that are full of entirely false information. But since they look legitimate, people share them and then they gain traction. It's a favorite among conspiracy theorists. I think that if you've got a legitimate journalist or a legitimate producer creating something that is on fire on YouTube and gaining a lot of popularity, it's worth looking at some of the bigger publications, the APs, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journals, to see whether they've analyzed it, to see whether they've picked it up, and to see whether they've debunked it. Again, Snopes is another good one. There was something recently that had to do with the coronavirus? I'm struggling to remember a bit, though I remember arguing with someone about it, because the doctor who it focused on had been discredited long ago. Another better example or easier example may be the link between vaccines and autism, right? Credible publication published the study. The author himself retracted it. I've spoken to the author himself. He's acknowledged that the data was bad, and yet people keep pointing to it to believe it. So now if you're looking for a reason not to vaccinate your child because you're worried, you can go to YouTube and you can find lots of legitimate looking videos supporting your point of view, even though the data that it's all based on has long ago been debunked. That's what makes things so difficult. There's still an element of trust when you see something that looks better produced than something you could do yourself. I'm not a videographer. I'm always impressed by what goes into a good looking video. That just because someone put a lot of effort into making it look shiny doesn't mean that the information in it is legit.
So we have time for maybe one or two more questions or comments. Mm-hmm. Mary Barbara, Margaret, will you call it? Yeah.
Barbara Valandry.
So what made you, when you began your career, be interested in journalism? And has that changed any in any way with the change in the media landscape?
Oh, great question. So I fell in love with journalism when I was six. And it was a New York Times story about Voyager 1 discovering that Jupiter's moon Io was acting like a baby Earth. I was kind of precocious, but I grew up with newspapers on the kitchen table all the time, and the news always came on after dinner. There was a TV in the kitchen, and as we grew older and ate dinner later, the news was on during dinner, and we always discussed it. And so that was the first thing that made me think, I want to know more about that, and I want to show people more about that, and I think there's more information out there than I can reach on my own, and I want to get it. In 6 years later, in 12th grade, I got a bad grade on a science project because the teacher told me I wasn't putting enough effort into it, so I decided that rather than put more effort into it, I would slack off, earn the lower grade, and put my effort into starting a newspaper for my classmates. And so I did that. I created a little newspaper for my fellow sixth graders where we interviewed different teachers and talked about what was going on at lunch and railed against the school dress code. No jeans. That's outrageous. And then I decided I wanted to be a doctor, a pediatrician, or a geneticist. I'm fascinated by genetics. And so I took all AP science classes, and my lab partner, David, looked at me as I was doing a horrible job dissecting a frog and said, "You are really bad at this, but you will spend hours and hours and hours at the school newspaper. You will spend hours and hours and hours reporting a story and talking to people. Do that, maybe." And I thought, you know, I'm coming from an Indian background and a Haitian background. I'm like, wait, you can do that? You don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to be a lawyer. And so I did that, and I loved it. And I loved not just the reporting and the gathering of information. I loved the editing, the polishing, the deciding what would go in the paper, the deciding how to present it. Does this story work better in a visual way? Should I do a gallery of photos? Would it work better if I just used quotes from people and let them tell their own story? I loved that. So I ended up going to Syracuse University, to the Newhouse School of Public Communications there. And I focused on print because I realized, ironically, that I didn't prefer being in front of the camera. I felt self-conscious. I've grown out of that since, and now I'm fine with it. But at the time, I really wanted to be the behind-the-scenes person getting the information and helping people decide what was important and pulling all of that together and helping people learn, which dovetails nicely with teaching in a lot of ways. So that's how I got into journalism. And I decided that while I was in college, I was working full-time for the Syracuse Post-Standard, the city's morning paper, while I was also going to school full-time. And I decided that the Globe was where I wanted to be. And so I hounded their recruiter when they came to the college campuses. And I, you know, barrage of questions, tailored what I was learning so that it would appeal. And then I got cold feet. And my advisor said, "What do you have to lose? If you apply, you lose the paper you printed your resume on, an envelope, and a stamp. The worst they can say is no, and that's all you've lost." So I applied while I was still partway through my senior year. And instead of saying no, they said yes. And so I was one of the youngest editors they ever hired. I started working in the Living Arts Department a week after my 21st birthday with people who had been in journalism longer than I'd been alive. And I loved it. I learned as much as I could from these veteran reporters and editors. And even though I shifted to online journalism, going to Yahoo and staying at US News, I realized that what I love about it is still identifying what's important and helping people understand it and offering context and putting things in their correct place in history and having documentation, I guess, in a way. It's almost like bearing witness to what's going on in the world. And I'm not brave enough to be a war correspondent. I know that. I'm raising a family. I still have two kids at home and three more out there in the world who are, you know, living their own lives as young adults. And I like thinking, at least, that maybe they're a little bit more informed because they couldn't escape the news at home. And maybe they're a bit more discerning about what they hear. And maybe they will, after all of this, take away the skill of learning how to learn on their own without relying on people to tell them, this is all you need to know. So that's kind of how I got into it and why I stay in it, even though the media is vilified routinely. All the big important things you wouldn't know about if reporters weren't digging for them.
Thank you, Lila. And thank you for staying with it. It's been really good to know that you're out there as a representative of journalism. So,
Mary Margaret, that's one.
There's one more question that doesn't have to be answered.
Yeah, we're out of time. Yeah.
I understand. I just want to make sure that Lila gets it. Can we get the links and sources that you mentioned today sometime? So
would it be helpful if I email them to Mary Rose and she can send them to the group?
Yes.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you all. You guys have been wonderful.
Let's thank Lila and Dorianne. And we'll go to announcements for next week. Next week, our topic is the perils and pride of patriotism. And we have our own Tim McCarthy. We say our own Tim McCarthy because he's been so many times and he loves to come and we love to be with him. He's currently the director of sexuality, gender, and human rights program at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. He's been associated with the Kennedy School of Government for many years. And he will be here as our main speaker. The focusers will be myself and my son, Michael. We have an ongoing dialogue about patriotism, and we do not feel the same way about it and have been affected differently by it. So that's next week. True Story Theater, which is another part of who we've enjoyed over many, many years at Women Explore, is having a fundraiser online on a Zoom next Tuesday, October 20th. And you can find out about it at truestory.com/events. They're a wonderful group. The fundraiser will be entertaining and engaging, and you'll probably learn something from it. It's at 7:00 on Tuesday, and it is a fundraiser for this program, which does a lot of work in the community to raise awareness about all the different ways that we are different and we are the same, and we are trying to search for new ways and perhaps utopia. So our fervent wish is that you come here with the intention of being here and sharing what we do with everybody that you sit at the dinner table with or that you meet on the bus or that you talk with in your life, and invite them to come as well. That's now possible because we're on Zoom. So people can come from Linda. Where is Linda? Linda's from Tennessee. People can come from any place and be part of us. We like to encourage conversation and deeper understanding and perhaps some activism and certainly some hope. And you can send our flyer through an e-flyer to people in your life, friends and family, and relations of all kinds. Next week at 10:00, if you click into our link, we will have an hour discussion about what happened today, what you've learned, what you've thought about, any questions or explorings that you've done. Then we take a break from 11 to 11:30 and start our program, The Perils and Prides of Patriotism. So we hope to see you there. And Susan just wrote on the chat that in order to get the links, save the chat, or you can copy and paste the chat too, I think. Can't you?
I'll include them in the email that I sent to Mary Rose.
Okay. And I need to make a little plug for Rhode Island, because one of my favorite things about Rhode Island is Trinity Repertory Company. So I am so glad you are down there, and you will love what they do if you don't already. And you will learn a lot from them. They give so much to community and to all the things that we talk about and think about. So
great. Anyway. Thank you for the tip.
Yep. Thanks. See you all next week.